Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's podcast features the remarkable Karen Horn speaking about Prisoners of Jan Smuts. Equally skilled in different trades and in the art of love, the Italian prisoners of war who were incarcerated in South Africa during the Second World War are a source of great fascination to this day. The first Italian POWs arrived in the Union of South Africa in early 1941, most of them being held in Zondervatte camp outside Cullinan or in work camps across the country. The government of Jan Smuts saw them as a source of cheap labor that would contribute to harvesting schemes, road building projects such as the old De Toit Kloof Pass between Paarl and Worcester, and even to prickly pear eradication schemes. Prisoners of Jan Smuts recounts the stories of survival and shenanigans of the Italian POWs in the Union through the eyes of five prisoners who had documented their experiences in memoirs and letters. Many opted to remain in South Africa once the war had ended, forging quite a legacy. These include sculptor Eduardo Villa, who left an important mark in the local and international art world, and businessman Aurelio Gatti, who built an ice cream empire whose gelato was to delight generations of South Africans. In this episode, Karen is in conversation with Monique Verdane, author and literary reviewer. Enjoy.
My name is Monique Verdane, and I am a book reviewer for Business Day. I'm also very interested in the history of World War II. And today I'm going to be chatting to Karen Horn, an author and historian, about her new book, Prisoners of Jan Smuts, which tells the story of Italian prisoners of war in World War II.
Hi, I'm Karen Horn. I'm a research fellow at the University of the Free State, and I've been writing about the Second World War since about 2010. This is my latest book, and I'm happy to discuss it with you today.
So, Karen, thank you for joining me. It's a remarkable book that has really captured my imagination. It's meticulously researched and incredibly moving. And it's about a moment in South Africa's history that I think is almost in danger of being forgotten. So just to give you some more background, my Italian mother grew up in Genoa during the war, and she came to South Africa when it ended, really to escape the poverty of post-war Italy, which you describe in the book. So my childhood was filled with stories about the war, the bombing of Genoa, and that sense of longing for the homeland, which is a consistent thread that runs through the lives of so many Italian South Africans. And we all used to visit Zondervatte every September to commemorate the lives of these 100,000 prisoners of war who lived there from 1941 to 1947, and who I think they've largely been remembered for dedicating themselves to creating in a time of destruction. So what inspired you to write Prisoners of Jan Smuts, and how does it connect to your earlier work in enemy hands?
I didn't really plan on writing this book. At the book launch of my first book, In Enemy Hands, somebody asked me out of the blue, what is your next project? And I didn't really have a next project at that moment, and the only thing I could think of was to carry on with the POW theme. So I just almost jokingly said, I'm going to write about the Italian POWs who came to South Africa. And then I started. That was in 2015. In 2016, I got some funding to go overseas to the archives, and that's when I really started with the research. And what I found in the beginning, like you say, the longing for home and longing and nostalgia is also something that remained in South Africa with the people who knew about the Italians. So I came across a lot of stories of people who lived on farms where they had Italians working on the farms, and they all remembered all the good things about the Italians. And so when I went to the archives, I found things that weren't so good. So then I had to marry these two sides of the story. So I hope I managed to do it sympathetically, but some people might find things in the book that they might not like so much. But I wrote what I found in the archives. And also, of course, the memoirs of a number of Italian POWs who came to South Africa.
So on that point, in the introduction, you write about bridging the gap between nostalgic recollections and actual historical events, and your duty as a historian to follow the evidence. I think it's extraordinary how you succeeded in capturing the romance of the popular legacy these POWs left, the shenanigans they got up to, and along with the crucial fact that they were the sons of fascism and how that played out. So would you talk a bit, discuss your research process? The recounting of the stories of prisoners of war comes with some very real critical challenges.
Well, the first thing I did was to try and find any living POWs that I could talk to. And that was quite difficult because it was a long time after the war and most of them had returned to Italy. And also, of course, I don't speak Italian, which was also quite a stumbling block for me during the research process. But I was lucky enough to find one man living in Pretoria, not very far from Zondervotte, where he spent the war. And I went to interview him. And from there, I managed to get hold of a few memoirs. There are quite a lot of memoirs. If you look at the Zondervotte.com website, they were all written in Italian. So I had to have those translated first before I could start. So it was quite a long process. And then after I did that, because I always feel more comfortable speaking, doing oral history so that I can get to know the people who experienced the past that I'm writing about. So I like to write about individuals because I think they give you insight, a better insight into the past, if you can see what they experienced through their eyes and how they saw it. When I had all of that material, then I went to the archives. And there are boxes and boxes and boxes of files in the military archives. And like I said, that's where I started discovering that the story about the Italians in South Africa was not always that positive. The fact that there were a large number of fascists among the Italians was quite a worry for the government and for the military authorities. Because, of course, there were many almost like-minded South Africans who did not like South Africa going to fight against Germany and the other fascist countries because they saw Germany as an ally almost. So the government had quite a issue on their hands to try and keep the Italian fascists and the local South Africans who felt more or less the same way away from each other. And of course, there were Italians who didn't really care about politics at all. So they had to eventually start separating these two groups into different sections of the camps. But throughout the war and afterwards, these two groups caused a lot of headaches for the military authorities. And also when they went out to work and getting in touch with local people, that was also quite a difficult thing to manage.
I think one of the most compelling part of the book is that it's the different stories of five men, Giovanni, Pietro, Luigi, Paolo, and Raffaello. What were the challenges in narrowing it down to these five POWs, and what were the reasons for selecting them? I know one was a chef, one was a tailor, one was a fascist through and through, and there was also a Pietro who escaped quite repeatedly.
Yes, I think these five men represent the entirety of the all of those who spent time in South Africa. So many of them would have been fascists like Giovanni, who never let go of his belief in or his loyalty towards Mussolini. Then there were others like Raffaello, who became a cooperator with the South Africans. And he just tried to make the best of a bad situation for himself. So he's the man who became a chef in the Pietermaritzburg camp. And then Paolo Ricci also spent most of all of his time in Zondervotte. he became quite involved with the theatres they had at Zondervater. He was a tailor and he made the theatre costumes. And then Pietro Scotto, I think the total time that he spent in a prisoner of war camp was about 2 weeks. As soon as he got to South Africa, he started planning his escape. So I follow his story because escape was a huge thing among the POWs. I think they must have realized that they couldn't get back to Italy. So especially in the beginning, many of these men tried to escape, I think, more to go and explore the countryside or see what South Africa was like. Pietro was one of the master escapers, and he was also very good at setting up a new life for himself in South Africa. And I think he would have stayed if it wasn't for the fact that he was captured just before a few weeks before he was repatriated. So, so I think they all represented different experience of the POWs who came to South Africa.
And just looking at the history of Zondervater, obviously it was, the biggest Allied POW camp of the Second World War. And with 100,000 prisoners, essentially it became a city. The hospital, sports facilities, schools for the illiterate who were taught to read and write by their fellow prisoners. And also the arts and crafts center and theaters and stage performances and their own orchestras and bands. How on earth did they manage to do all of these things? How did they keep their culture and their spirits alive in the midst of a prisoner of war camp?
Well, I think with great difficulty, especially in the first 2 years that the camp existed, the camp commandant at that time, De Wet, was completely overwhelmed by the number of POWs who arrived at Zondervater. They weren't prepared at all for the high numbers. I think because even the Union Defence Force never expected to capture so many Italians in East Africa and North Africa. So when these men started arriving, they arrived in a camp that was not yet completed. There were tents instead of barracks. The food was not according to what the Geneva Convention stipulated. So the first 2 years were complete chaos. And Jan Smuts tried very hard to change that because obviously he wanted to show Britain that South Africa was still a loyal country despite the number of people in South Africa who did not agree with him taking South Africa into war. They had to get this camp up to standard as quick as possible. Eventually, they replaced De Wet with Colonel Prinsloo. But Prinsloo also got a lot more support from the military authorities. He got a bigger staff. By the time he took over, there were fewer POWs in South Africa. So he had an easier time. But I still can't imagine, if I look at the amount of paperwork in the archives, how these people got through all of the administration work they had to do. It's just amazing. For each person who went out to a farm to work, there was paperwork. For each one who tried to escape or who escaped successfully, there was a court of inquiry. So I don't know, they must have worked almost 24 hours, the staff at the camp, to just keep on top of everything. And so it's also important to remember that it was a very big camp, but at no point were there 100,000 prisoners all at the same time. The largest number was about 60,000 because they came and went all the time. But if you look at everybody who entered the camp, that is close to 100,000 people. So, but they weren't all there at the same time.
And in your research, what did you discover about how the Italians kept their culture going and kept on applying their own professions to where they were living and do things like build theatres and, create orchestras and bands? How did they go about doing that?
Well, music was one of the first things they started with when they arrived at Zondervater, even before the camp became a more acceptable place to live. So before they even had musical instruments, which the Red Cross provided, they started singing to each other. So some of them sang opera and, you know, popular songs and so on. But that was, even if they were in different sections of the camp, they could hear each other sing, especially in the evenings. So they used to sit and listen to different people singing in the camp. And as things improved in the camp, they were able to start with new projects, like setting up theatres. These weren't theatres like you would imagine them to be. They were just maybe a makeshift stage where they would, you know, perform a play or an opera or whatever the case may be. And also, at the start, they just started playing soccer. You know, they organized themselves into teams, and they didn't rely on the camp staff to do things for them or to provide, because I think they must have seen that, you know, it's unless they do something, nothing is going to happen, and they couldn't just sit still and wait for the war to end. It was only when Prinsloo took over that the schools started to become a part of the Zondervater experience. The schools and the trade school, the exhibitions they had with the arts and crafts. So that's when these things became, you know, easier to make available for the prisoners as time went on.
Then my next question is just looking at how did Smuts justify the use of POW labor, and was there any opposition to this?
Well, I think Smuts had two reasons for bringing the POWs to South Africa. Firstly, he wanted to show Britain that he could make a significant contribution to the war, because the soldiers who volunteered to go and fight the South Africans were very few, and they didn't really make, they fought in Eastern and Northern Africa and in Italy. But compared to America or Britain, they made a very small contribution to the war. And it was with the POWs that Smuts knew he could show that South Africa could contribute. So that's why he wanted more and more POWs to come to South Africa. On the other hand, he also wanted a labor force in South Africa. And he knew that he could use these Italians to work on farms and to do manual labor. Because he didn't want officers, Italian officers, to come to South Africa. He wanted the rank and file soldiers. So these were mostly illiterate men who was used to doing manual labor. They were used extensively in South Africa, on the farms especially, but also in the Tsitsikamma forest, building roads and all kinds of things. So that was a good time for South Africa if you think about cheap labor. because the Italians wanted to get out of the camp, and they got this opportunity when they were being used for labor.
You mentioned in the book some of the lasting impacts that they had, especially with construction and building roads. Do you want to mention some of them?
Well, I think one of the most well-known buildings is the church in Pietermaritzburg that the prisoners built themselves, and Raffaello was actually also involved in that. He didn't participate in building, but he cooked for the builders, so he was very proud of that fact. They also built the Toyskloof Pass, but this is the old pass, not the one we use today. So they built that road. There were even some of the men who worked on the Voortrekker Monument with the marble and so on. So they, in all different fields of society, they made contributions. And there were also, of course, those who stayed behind and then after the war continued to make contributions, especially with music and art and so on.
There's a very significant and poignant moment in the book where Raffaello remembers how a UDF officer tries to prepare them for the journey home and all the changes that have happened in Italy during their absence, including obviously the shift to democracy. He wrote in his memoirs that the POWs felt abandoned by their homeland and by everyone, like degenerate, forgotten children. and so far from home physically and emotionally. How did they confront that? And what is the, I think the story of the UDF officer trying to explain this to them is really an incredibly poignant moment.
Well, they had to prepare them to go back home. And a part of this preparation was to try and inform them about the situation in Italy, because many of them wrote letters home, but they didn't necessarily receive letters from Italy during the war. Italy was being bombed. There was a civil war going on between the fascists and those who supported the Allies. It was really difficult to just survive in Italy. And in the meantime, the Italians in South Africa were living in relative luxury compared to the people in Italy. So they had to be educated on what had happened in Italy, because also many of them still felt loyal, even though Mussolini was deposed and towards the end of the war he was killed. Many still felt very loyal towards him and what he stood for. And they almost refused to believe what happened in Italy. So again, the fascists among the Italians would have seen this differently as those who came to other insights during the war while they were in Sonderwater. So for many, the experience in South Africa was almost an experience of how to live in a democratic society. Although at that point, South Africa was not truly democratic yet, but they got a feeling of even just being able to say what you feel or to have an opinion about something, because when they were young men in Italy, it could be dangerous for you to express your opinion if the authorities didn't agree with you. So just that small thing of saying what you think was a new experience for many of these men. So now they were on their way back to Italy, and some of them went back to towns that had been obliterated by Allied bombing, by Germans who were retreating back towards Germany. So I think for many of them, going back to Italy would have been a terrible shock. Yeah, I think there's one photograph in the book of somebody who made a painting with a man reading a letter from home. And often these letters would include very bad news, like a mother or a father who had died, or, you know, family members or friends. So that was a very common thing, and they had to, I don't know, it must have been very difficult. I don't know how I would have, you know, dealt with that situation, being far away and not really knowing what was going on.
And in the process of your research and writing the book, did you come across a sort of nostalgic view of Italians that some South Africans still hold to this day?
Yes, very much so, which is why I found it quite difficult to write at one point, because I became aware of this, all of these ideas that the South Africans had about the Italians. And they would tell me about these ideas or the stories they had. The more I looked at my archival material, the more I realized that many of these ideas are based on, stories that had been carried over from one generation to the next and which didn't really have much truth to them, or, you know, told only one side of the story. So I became a bit, at one point, a bit almost too hesitant to write about this, because I thought, you know, if anybody reads what I'm finding in the archives, you know, it might have leave a very negative impression on the readers. But then, you know, if you're a historian, you have an obligation to write what you find. So I thought I'll just write it and then see what happens. And, you know, maybe if somebody feels very strongly about that, I could just refer them to the archives.
Would you agree that the legacy of Sonderwater, or the number of prisoners who stayed there, have had an influence on the community, the Italian community in South Africa, and just in terms of food and decor and all of those kinds of things. Would you say it comes from that post-war period when many of them stayed?
I think they had a huge impact. Before the war, there were very few Italians in South Africa. So the greatest number of Italian immigrants came as a result of the Italians who were here during the war. I think the aspect of food and culture and Italian art and so on may have arrived a bit later after the war. I know Paolo said he tried to import pasta and other Italian foodstuffs into South Africa in the 50s, and that didn't really work because the people in South Africa, they weren't familiar with that kind of food. So it was only much later that that kind of cuisine reached our shores. I can remember when we started getting sun-dried tomatoes in the shops. You know, it was a new thing for South Africans, and that was quite recent when you think in historical terms. So I think South Africans first had to go through a phase where they had to liberate themselves and, you know, open themselves up for new experiences. And I don't think that happened so much during the apartheid era, which followed soon after the war.
Just looking at some of the reasons for those who stayed behind, what did you discover? What were those reasons? What kept them here instead of returning to the homeland?
Well, like we spoke about earlier, they knew that Italy was very poor and in a terrible state. So that was one reason why many wanted to stay. Another reason was that many of them found jobs in South Africa. So obviously, if you are now, you've become, you know, you learned to read and write during the war and you have a job, why would you want to go back to Italy and start all over again? And then there were those who, while they were working on farms, many of them fell in love with the farmer's daughter. They wanted to stay with them. At first, it wasn't allowed for any marriages between Italians and South Africans. But as time went on, the authorities sort of, I think, almost gave up and allowed this to happen. There were different reasons why they stayed. And also, by the way, the matter of escaping started, the reasons for escape started to change towards the end of the war, because some of them had bad experiences on the farms, so they escaped from the farms to go back to Zonderwater. Others worked on farms, maybe fell in love or was offered a job on the farm, and then when they were brought back to Zonderwater, they escaped to try and go back to their workplace to avoid repatriation. So escaping was almost like a two-way street for the Italians. There were all kinds of different reasons why they wanted to escape.
In the chapter, I Also Need So Much to Cry, you write about Paolo following the advice of his friends to stay. And I wondered if you would mind just reading that section, the last section of that chapter, to give listeners some idea of what they can expect.
So this is the last chapter of the book, and it's about Paolo's decision that he had to make towards, you know, just before the last repatriation took place. So Paolo followed the advice of his friends, and the three of them decided to make a living in South Africa. Waiting for Italy to get back on her feet would in all probability take years. Italy was a poor country before the war started, but by mid-1945, workers earned half of what they had done before the war. Food rations were also in place well after the war came to an end, and those who were unable to grow subsistence crops were forced to weather the high prices on the black market. It was only in 1949 that the situation started to improve, but then only marginally. In 1953, Italy began a process of industrialization, and the effect it had on the economy became known as the so-called economic miracle. The period of growth slowed down again only in 1973. In contrast, the economy in South Africa was doing very well, and 15 years after the war, only Japan's economy was growing at a faster pace. Although nobody could predict the future, especially after the war had wrought so much havoc, Paolo and his friends made the right decision, at least financially. At an emotional level, though, it was not such an easy decision to make, and Paolo found it very difficult. Paolo and Lottie worked for the dressmaker for 18 months, but for them, things moved too slowly. Ultimately, they wanted to do their own thing. It was only then, when by chance they met a Jewish gentleman, that things started to change. With this man's help, they were able to establish their own workshop in a basement of a hotel. But after months of watching Chu pass by on the pavement above, they convinced their benefactor that a basement was not the place for them. A first room floor in a building on the corner of Pretorius and Van der Walt streets, large enough to be divided into two sections, one for sleeping and one for working, gave Paolo and Lottie the opportunity they had been waiting for. They hung a sign on the balcony advertising their services, Lottie and Richie Italian Tailors. Their business grew, and with it, their premises improved. For Paolo, life without his Italian family became more bearable when, I quote, he met a wonderful girl who came from one of the most renowned families in Pretoria. Within 18 months of meeting each other, we got married, and as a wedding gift, Nonno Pietro paid our trip to Italy. In those days, there were no planes, and so we traveled by ship. The ship was called Jerusalem, and it took 26 days to travel from Durban to Venice. Our honeymoon lasted 5 months. In 2016, referring to their honeymoon, Paolo jokingly recalled, "The only thing when you come back, the honey is finished, and it was only the moon." Paolo and Fosca were married for 60 years. Yet when I asked Paolo about his decision to stay in South Africa, he became emotional. He was never quite convinced that he made the right choice. His vivid memory of the day the last repatriation train left the station without him remained with him for many years. I quote, "I was a South African civilian already, and I was living near the station, and so I said, I want to go see these Italians, my friends leaving. And I tell you, when that train started to swish, I went on my knees and cried. I think the cement is still wet today."
Thank you for that. Emotionally, dramatically appropriate for Italians. Talking about Zondervotto, how is it remembered today? Are these POWs' experiences still remembered and commemorated in any way?
I think among the Italian community, it still is a big thing for them. It's commemorated every year. In September, they have a service at Zondervotto. As far as I know, Zondervotto is open to the public by appointment, so you can go and see. They're quite a large graveyard of the POWs who did not survive the war. So I think among the Italian community, the war plays a bigger role in their memory than the war plays for most South Africans. Unfortunately, most South Africans, when they think about history, they think more about apartheid than anything else. And this First and the Second World War is mostly forgotten. But not for the Italians. For them, the Second World War is a big thing, and they make a big thing about it every year. So there's also, for instance, the Zondervotto Block, which is a veterans society, and they keep in touch with each other. It's still quite prominent in the memory of the Italians in South Africa.
Karen, you've written such a compelling and nuanced narrative, and you've shed light on a really relatively unexplored aspect of World War II history. I think the most remarkable thing about the book has been your ability to weave together these personal stories with the broader historical context and the valuable insights into the struggles and resilience of these POWs, but also their lasting impact on other individuals and communities. Thank you for ensuring that these voices from the past are heard. The book has educated me, but it's also been profoundly moving. Thank you so much for this chat.
Thanks, Monique. It was very good to chat to you, and thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.